His real name is Jack Kevorkian, but he's surely better known by his nickname, Dr. Death. More than anybody else, this American pathologist has propelled the issue of assisted suicide to international attention. Dr. Kevorkian has helped scores of people he says were seriously ill to take their own lives to escape the agony of terminal illness. Many have praised him. Others have accused him of being a criminal and a publicity seeker. And Dr. Jack Kevorkian, now 79, has only recently been released from serving a prison sentence for the homicide of someone he says he was trying to help. Jack Kevorkian, the 4th of June 1990, a woman called Janet Adkins. You helped her to die. She was the first person you helped to die. Describe how she came to you.
I had developed a device after consulting a young man who had a surfboarding accident in California and broke his neck. And he was paralyzed from the neck down for 20 years in a nursing home. And he openly advertised in the newspaper for some doctor to help him die. Well, none came forward, but I went over to talk to him. And I says, well, I'd be glad to help you, but I can't do it right now myself because it's illegal. But I'll try to figure a way to do it. And I went home and thought, and that's how the machine was born.
This was a device which essentially gave a lethal injection to somebody.
Right.
First put them into a coma and then gave them a lethal injection, right, which ended their life.
Yes. It was self-administered.
In other words, the doctor or whoever was looking after the machine wouldn't be the person who would press the button.
No, they would press the button when they wanted.
So Janet Adkins becomes the first person. As I say, how did she come to you?
First of all, I put small advertisements in the local newspapers so for people who were terminal or suffering for counseling. And then I could explain to them what I had in mind. I didn't get any responses to that, but word got out on it anyway. And then one of the magazines, national news magazines, put a little notice of it, and Janet's husband saw it in Oregon and called me.
What happens when you go to see them for the first time?
Well, actually, they called me first by phone, by telephone. I told them that she's going to need a psychiatric consultation. And they told me that the psychiatrist had said that she's rational and could make her own decision.
But the issue was you, when you were going through this process, needed proof that she was of sound mind and that there were valid medical reasons for her wanting to die.
And then I would request medical records. I requested medical records from her own physician, so I could see what they thought and what they recommended.
She was suffering from Alzheimer's, am I correct?
That's right. She was terrified. She already had terrible memory loss. She was a very intelligent woman and didn't want to go on to end stages of Alzheimer's. She just dreaded it.
What did she say to you?
She says she just wanted to end this torture of what's coming.
You used the machine and she died. Now, as a result of that, you were prosecuted. The prosecutor in that case says she wasn't terminally ill, she wasn't in any pain, and what you were really doing was trying to advance your cause.
No. I was trying to eliminate the suffering of a patient. You know, it isn't just pain that you suffer from. People who are paralyzed from the neck down often want to end it too. In Holland, in the Netherlands, they finally expanded it to psychiatric cases. I've talked to people who are psychiatric who many have written to me that they want to end it because all their lives they've been in and out of institutions and nothing's changed and they're suffering.
There is a videotape in which you are seen speaking with Janet Adkins and her husband. And you say, have I encouraged you in any way to do this? She and her husband answer to that no. And then you say, you understand, of course, that I prefer. She does change her mind. The end of human life is never desirable. Did you really mean that?
Of course.
You weren't just saying it because the camera was rolling.
Because I had placed
it wasn't self-serving.
I empathize.
To get you out of future trouble.
I had no idea. First of all, I wasn't afraid because at that time there was no law in the state against assisting a suicide. They passed it after I acted. I empathize with the patient. What would I want in the patient's place? I have a fairly good imagination. And so I would say, of course, if I change my mind, I want that option. Only one of four or five people I talked to went ahead with it. The others didn't. And several of them, when we finished the discussion, later I heard that they had gone on. The family would write to me and say they went on and died naturally because after they talked to you, they never complained about pain anymore. because they had the option, the freedom of that option. It eased their mind. And so they went on and died naturally. That, I think, was a great service. That's better than really helping them die.
How many people have you assisted in their suicides?
There were about a little over 130.
You surely weren't able to get to know all of them or spend the proper amount of time with all of them.
Why not? I had a decade.
Did you really? So with every single patient?
1990 to 1999.
With every single patient?
Well,
because your critics say that that's not the case. That
130 patients.
There were many of them who came in, you knew them for 24 hours before they died.
Not true. If I did, I had a tremendous amount of medical material on them from their own doctors. Many of the doctors had already written. There's nothing more we can do. They wrote that. Well, what's the patient going to do now? Where does he turn? At least I gave them an option. And that's why they went on living, many of them. They had another option. So they had the freedom of mind then. Their mind wasn't panicky. It could concentrate on other things.
There is one case, Marjorie once, who certainly was in pain, but other physicians have suggested it was psychosomatic. The autopsy said they could find no physical cause for her pain. In that case, did you proceed with helping to kill someone?
No.
Who didn't need to die?
No, because her own physician was with me when she signed permission. He knew. The others who were criticizing didn't know her case. And I knew the patient, too. She was suffering, and it was more than one meeting with her. Many more than one meeting. I mean, she could go on living with pain for years, if that's what she wanted. Self-determination. That's the key to my proceeding on this.
Let me just talk a bit about your own personal background. You're the son of Armenian emigres who came here because of a genocide in the Ottoman Empire. How much, when you were growing up here as a young American, but as the child of emigres, how much did they talk about that whole atmosphere of murder that they fled from?
Surprisingly, not much. Only when we asked questions, they would answer them, especially my mother. My mother suffered more than my father. He had left the country before, but unfortunately they wiped out his family, and that he suffered with. My mother suffered by going through the desert, where the women and children and old men were driven across the deserts of Iraq. And she lost three of her family there on that trek. She had nightmares. As many times we had to wake her up, she'd end up moaning loudly. But she never complained when she was awake. Only answer our questions. Never voluntarily talked about the trouble she went through.
The reason I ask you that question is because I've spoken to many Armenians over the years and investigated the legacy of the Armenian genocide. And I would say 99% of the people I've spoken with, even though it's generations down, have been traumatized by what happened. And I'm just wondering, in your own childhood, how that memory of violent death, how present it was.
No, the only thing concerned me mainly was how unfair it was. You know, how can some humans be so evil for such brutality on other people? This bothered me.
Did it make you the kind of person who would want to take a stand?
No. This had nothing to do with euthanasia. Nothing. My background, that I can put a finger on. It's being a physician, having seen patients suffer, that consolidated that in my mind.
Mind you, one of the patients who did suffer,
yes,
when you were young, was your mother.
She had terrible cancer that spread all over. Every bone in her body was riddled. That was painful. And she was wasted away to about 80 pounds, weak, moaning, and so doped up with narcotics that she was in a different world, saying names and things that we never heard before. My younger sister asked the doctor if he couldn't help her die. I didn't know that till years later.
What did he say?
Of course, he refused. They're afraid of prosecution. Or, personally, maybe they didn't like it.
When you look back at what happened to your mother, did that at any stage inspire you, help to inspire you?
No. It's seeing patients in my medical training, especially my internship. I saw a couple of patients that just boggle the mind. A child with hydrocephalus, a body about maybe two feet long, and a head about 3 feet long, full of water, lying like a balloon full of water. There's no brain there. And that's being kept alive. When I saw that, and a suffering cancer patient, and it didn't make me a fanatic, It didn't make me a real activist at that time, but I knew euthanasia was a necessary option.
Where did the nickname Dr. Death come from? Because it didn't. Many people assume that it comes from your involvement in assisted suicide, but it predates that.
Oh, yes. It was first used by people in the hospital when I was a resident in pathology, when I was doing work on the eye signs of death to tell when a person's dead or can be resuscitated. And I'd go around in the evening and check people who were terminal and try to be there and hook up a cardiogram to try to see the eye when the moment of death happens by the heart rate and by the cardiogram. And they start playfully calling me Dr. Death.
You also went to prisons and you asked condemned men if they would be willing to submit to experiments prior to execution. Yes. What was that for?
It's obvious what that was for. We could do research we can't do otherwise. I mean, we could have had heart transplants and we could have had a lot of medical advances years before they happened because we had the opportunity to do anything we wanted with their permission under anesthesia. They're under general anesthesia and are not aware of what's going on, and then they never wake up, but with their permission, instead of being electrocuted or hanged. And many of them would choose it.
So they would die, and the doctor would become the instrument of their death after the experiments had been carried out.
Or if the experiment is not lethal, the doctors can walk away when they got the information they wanted, and someone else, an executioner, come in and could finish it with an injection.
Can you see how people looking at that would see in it shades of Mengele or the Japanese experimentation units in Manchuria during the war and be horrified by it?
Well, let them be horrified. They're not horrified. What they're horrified about is that it seems like a violent death to them, a brutal death. When it's not, it's the best death. You think it's better to see a man hanged or electric chair burning them up and so their eyes pop? And doctors said that was okay, the doctors who first saw it. What's wrong with putting them to sleep like you do for surgery and they never wake up?
Can you see how people might see you as being creepy?
Sure, because they feel death is creepy.
Even a bit nutty?
Huh?
Even a bit nutty?
Even more than a bit nutty, but it doesn't matter. I mean, every advance, you get called names.
You never married, you never had children. Do you regret that?
Sometimes, but not now. I agree with William James.
That's William James, the philosopher.
This is not the kind of world I want to bring anyone else into.
That's a very, very morbid...
Well, he's
pessimistic.
Morbid. Call William
point
James
of
morbid.
View. No, but that's your own point of view.
Sure.
What makes you say that?
Just looking around me and experiencing life. You know, when you're a child, it's wonderful. It's la-la.
Maybe it's not experiencing life you're talking about. It's being too close to death for so long.
Look, that's what
makes you think
Talk to some children in Iraq. Ask them the question.
Well, I do. I have, actually.
And they want.
I know that people want life.
Well, then.
More than anything.
As you get older... It's many, many, many famous people, when they got older, denigrated life. Heinrich Heine, the writer, said, "Sleep is lovely. Death is better still. Not to have been born is, of course, the miracle."
Maybe you never lived.
Well, maybe. I've lived better than many people, but I still am judging what is the purpose of your being here. No one knows. Everyone's got a different opinion.
Maybe it's a life that has room for love.
Love, we don't know what you're talking about with love. I mean, you can say that, and if it makes you feel good, fine. It's like religion. If it makes you feel good, fine. I don't need it. I don't have to have the word L-O-V-E as a justification of liking life. I just look at what I think life is. I'm in life. I am part of it. And I judge the way I feel about it.
Are you an arid rationalist?
I suppose, but I don't know if I'm not always totally rational.
A lot of the criticism of you has also centered around the sort of means of death that you bring to people. Mm-hmm. For example, people dying in the back of your Volkswagen van with a gas mask over their faces and carbon monoxide being pumped into them.
That's right. Well, first of all,
does it cause you any level of personal discomfort seeing people die?
Of course it does. But it's not my doing. It's out of my control. Who's responsible for that? First of all, they yanked my license. I couldn't get the drugs. They forced me to take other means. Why did I do it? Because the patient wanted this done. I did only what the patient wanted. And I had to use the means available, which society limited to me. Another thing about the van. It was a clean van. I slept in it many times. It was a very comfortable thing to sleep in.
And why did you have to use a van? What was the
specific reason?
It's
the only place I could do it. Every place refused because I was honest about it. I told them what I was going to do. And they all were afraid.
And couldn't you do it in your home?
What would that do? It would throw me out of my home. I'd be evicted. You want me to do that? So the van was the only solution because that was a moving room which I had control over.
But you can see again, can't you? Here you are driving around in a van with gas. That's what the Nazis used to do.
Well, can I help with what the Nazis did? Don't compare me with Nazis, because the big difference is informed consent.
Isn't there going to be always, though, a big argument on this issue of informed consent? Because if you have people who are in extreme pain or in extreme psychological difficulty, are they going to be able to give you informed consent?
Why not? I inform them, and I make sure they understand. The whole family had to agree, and I often had multiple visits, not just one. In some cases, I visited with the family and the patient 6 to 7 times.
Has any family ever sued you?
No.
One of the things that your critics say is that you've got no credentials whatsoever for dealing with people who are depressed, who may not be in a proper state of mind to reach the kind of terminal decision.
Well, we always try to get psychiatric consultation.
But you're someone who spent your life, medical life, dealing with dead bodies. Are the dying?
Well,
people who are on the point of death are dead.
Yes, but when I worked in this, we always tried to get psychiatric consultation. But the other doctors boycotted me because of the stigmatization and because they were afraid for their licenses.
So you still went ahead even without that psychiatric consultation?
Because luckily later on I was joined by another doctor who believed in this, who was a psychiatrist. That helped. But yes, I mean, any normal person can tell if someone's crazy after a while. An intelligent person. You could. After you talk to them for a while, you can see if they're crazy.
Did you ever doubt your own sanity?
Pardon?
Did you ever doubt your own sanity?
Never. Why should I? I haven't done anything that's, I think, crazy. What I did, euthanasia, was right. I've done foolish things. There's a lot of folly in my life, but not insanity.
What was foolish? What did you do that was foolish?
Some ventures I tried to do, and a movie I tried to make, books I used to write, a couple of books earlier. Yeah, a lot of things.
But do you have a capacity for self-criticism when it comes to this whole issue?
Sure.
But have you ever doubted the morality of what you're doing?
Never. If I doubted the morality, I wouldn't do it.
And you've questioned yourself deeply on this?
Of course. Not really. Not deeply. I look at the situation and say, what is my duty as a physician? I'm a physician. Pathologist. Sure, I didn't see patients, but I've done it in the past. Now, what is my duty?
Because, of course, it can get to the point, can it not, where you might have families who want to be rid of somebody.
Well, it's still the patient's wish.
So you would never do anything unless the patient themselves...
I had a couple of families where the first patient said, I don't want my relatives there. They were estranged. They didn't get along. And he didn't want them there. So we went along with his wishes. It's what the patient wants. He tells us where he wants it done and when.
There were prolonged legal battles here in Michigan and in the Supreme Court. You win, you lose, you win. The issue of assisted suicide becomes a major, not just a national issue in the United States, but internationally as a result of what you do. But you were eventually convicted of homicide, I think second-degree homicide, in the case of a 52-year-old man, Thomas Yoke. you videoed the whole procedure and allowed it to be shown on television, on primetime television in America. Why did you do that?
Many people thought I was a fool to do that. But they didn't know what my motive was. We knew from a previous case heard by the Supreme Court that they wanted a case. I had no standing to go to the Supreme Court. They call it no standing, legal term. They wanted a case that was particularized. That was the word they used. I says, okay, I made my mind up. We'll give them a particularized case and get this decided once and for all. End it.
So like offering yourself as a sacrifice?
Well, I don't think it was.
And the person you were
assisting. I gave them what they wanted.
It
wasn't a sacrifice. They said particularized case, which I gave them. I just did what I knew I had to do.
Did you think you'd win?
No. I knew the court was corrupt. But I didn't know how corrupt. But I found out when the Supreme Court in the state and the big, vaunted United States Supreme Court both refused to take a constitutional issue that had never been decided on a case. That is malpractice.
You describe the court as corrupt. You call it malpractice. Well, let me put another point of view. Justice Richard Thompson said, we're a government of laws and everyone should obey the law regardless of whether they think it's a good law or not.
Really?
Now, you mightn't like the law. You can call it all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But surely you have a responsibility to obey it.
Obey? Well, why, really? We had a law that said you got to return slaves that run away back. You got to turn them back to the owner. Should that be obeyed? The only ones that were moral, the ones who broke that law and let the slave be free. You understand now? It's so easy to criticize without knowing what you're saying.
At your trial, you end up being convicted and being sent to prison. Were you shocked at that moment?
No. I smiled.
How many years did you spend inside?
Almost 8.5.
What was it like in prison?
It's like adapting to any way of life. It's all you do is put your mind to it. It's unpleasant. The worst part of it was boredom plus lack of freedom to move, to do what you want. Otherwise, you meet good and bad guys. You have no social life. There's no contact with females except for guards and nurses. It's one, you meet good people, bad people, thugs, and wonderful people. I met people that I'd have friends any day. Murderers. They're in for murder. Some mistake they made when they were a teenager or a young adult.
People might find that ironic. Dr. Death becoming friends with murderers. The
well,
man
they don't consider
who helped many people.
They never considered
more than 100 people on their way.
Well, most of the inmates didn't consider me Dr. Death, really. They didn't consider me Dr. Death. They were quite friendly, most of them, including the guards.
Was it ever frightening?
No. No, I wasn't frightened, but you have to be careful what you say to some of them because they all have short tempers. You say the wrong thing or something that they don't agree with or they find offensive, they get violent.
Really? And you would have been in, what, your late 60s, early 70s?
I'd have been in my 70s.
Were you ever attacked physically?
No, but I've had a fist thrust in my face several times.
You're dying yourself now.
Yes, I face death frequently. Psychiatrists have said it's healthful to think of death every day.
You're sick at the moment. What are you sick with?
I have hepatitis, which we got in a research project about 15 years ago.
How did that come about?
Well, we were doing work on blood from dead people to transfuse, and we wanted to see how long it lasted, so we tagged them with a radioactive substance. And for the control blood, we tagged the blood from the corpses. And then we had control blood. We took a blood from the blood bank, which we thought was good blood. Well, it was infected with hepatitis C, which at that time was unknown. They had no way of testing for it. And so three of us who received a tiny bit of it to see how long it lasted in our body, we got hepatitis.
How long more do you have, do you know?
It depends. You can't predict the course of the disease. Sometimes it's immediately fatal. Other times it goes on for years and then it turns into a rampant infection that destroys your liver. Or it turns into cancer.
What will you do when you feel yourself becoming really ill?
Well, I want this right for me. I'm doing it for me. If it helps other people, fine. See, I'm selfish too. I'm a little selfish. And I thought this is okay because I'm sure what I want, a lot of people want. I want the choice. Do I want to go on with this suffering thing or do I not want to go on? I want the choice. How can they? They can't take that choice away from me with a law. They can only stop me from using it. Now, that's why you can't control suicide, because you can't stop it with a law.
When the time comes at the end, will you take your own life?
I don't know. I want the option. It's my choice. That's what freedom's about, isn't it? Why should a law say, no, you do that, and we're going to put the person who helps you into prison? See? And that fear controls everybody. Well, it didn't control me, because I knew it was right.
Since you've come out of prison, how do you fill your days? What do you do?
I'm doing a lot of studying and reviewing, and euthanasia is a tertiary subject to me, of tertiary importance. Secondary is crime control reform. That's a big issue, too, because it needs it. We're in a crime crisis in this country. Prison's overflowing. We have to let prisoners out early, put them on tether, and people are frightened. And the first issue, prime importance, is our rights based on the Ninth Amendment and the Constitution. We are lucky. Americans have in their highest law of the land, the Constitution, which says you are born with all natural rights. And that is overlooked. It's never been used in 230 years since the Constitution was written.
If you were able to put into words what you hoped your legacy would be, what would you say?
It doesn't matter, really. I've never thought much about that. There are going to be people still who condemn me. All the religious people are going to hate me. They're going to vilify my memory. And I know why.
Does it bother you being vilified?
I'm not being vilified. They're vilifying me. It's their words, but I'm not what they say I am. I know what I am. You can call me anything you want, but I know what I am. See?
What is that?
An unemployed physician. That's all. Now fighting for rights and for prison reform.
Jack Kevorkian, thank you very much.
You're welcome.